Hi, everyone, and welcome to another session of the second annual No Hype Copywriting Telesummit. My name is Marcia Yudkin from www.yudkin.com, and I'm your host for the series. Today's expert guest is Vicki Sullivan, a very savvy strategist for experts, authors, professional speakers, and aspiring thought leaders of all sorts, and I've been following her for years. Vicki started off in public relations for a health association, then she worked for government, and then she became an agent and promoter for speakers. Then she moved into analyzing trends for speakers and advising them on how to hook into those trends. She now serves on the Women's Leadership Board for the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and is a contributing editor for RainToday.com, a large online community of service professionals. Her market intelligence updates are distributed to experts in 18 countries, and if you're an author, expert, or speaker of any sort, or work for those who are, you definitely want to be on her list. Her website is VickiSullivan.com, and Vicki is V-I-C-K-I-E. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Marcia. I'm thrilled to be here.
Thank you. So let's dig in, and Vicki, tell us how you define positioning, which is our topic for today, and how does it come into play when we're promoting ourselves, a company, or an expert who's our client?
Sure. Positioning, Marcia, is a very big word, and it means different things to different folks. Many times, positioning, branding, messaging, and copywriting, they're used interchangeably. So as a market strategist for thought leaders, I see them as separate things. Positioning is the art and science of creating a mental picture inside the heads of our best clients. It is a group of strategic decisions, word usage, copywriting to influence how we are perceived. The messaging or messages, those are the tools. Those are the things we choose to highlight and share that create our killer mental picture. And branding is the story we clients tell themselves about us. So that story is based on a wide variety of things in copywriting, which includes the position, which is based on the messaging. So positioning is part of the branding. So if you could see it like a wheel, if you could just visualize a big wheel, like a bicycle wheel or a big tire, branding is the wheel. Positioning is the hub of that wheel. And our messages and our copywriting, those are the spokes of the wheel.
Okay, so I'm trying to picture this. So positioning is the hub of the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, it's the center, it's the, so tell me how being in the center fits into the whole structure.
Positioning is the hub of the wheel. That's where all the messages, all the copywriting emulates from. It is that core hub mental picture that people have. Okay? So when you look at your copywriting, the messages that you want to convey, the words you want to use, the story you want to tell, they all have to lead back to one place, which is your positioning. Your positioning is creating a mental picture. It is a group of strategic decisions that we make to influence how we are perceived.
Okay, so how, let's make this concrete with an example.
Sure.
So tell me, such and so and so, either a real person or a composite of a type of client that you serve, what would be the positioning, what would be the branding, what would be the message, and so on?
Sure. One of my favorite examples is Marcus Buckingham. Okay? Marcus Buckingham has a brand. He's seen as a thought leader. He's written a lot of best-selling books on first find your strengths, you know, break your rules, all that kind of stuff. So he is seen as a thought leader in using your strengths. That's his brand. Okay? That's his brand. The position that he has, the territory that he claims, is he is an architect of the strength revolution. So the mental picture that Marcus Buckingham creates with all of his messages is he is an advocate for using your strengths. He's an advocate. He's an encourager. He is an advocate for corporate America to evaluate someone's potential and performance by how they use their strengths, not how they shore up their weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
So he calls himself the architect of the strengths revolution. That
mm-hmm.
is the mental picture that he wants everyone to have. So that's his positioning. Okay?
Got it.
The messages are all the spokes and all the books and all the copywriting, everything he does that goes back to that central theme.
Okay.
Did that help?
Yes. Yes.
Fabulous.
So our goal, if we're promoting ourselves, we need to start with the positioning because that's the hub. If you create the spokes without paying attention to the hub, the whole thing is going to fall apart, if I'm
exactly.
understanding your analogy correctly.
Exactly. You got it.
Okay. Good. So now this positioning does not happen in a vacuum, and this is part of what you're always talking about. Every single issue of your market intelligence report that I read. And you do a lot of market research to find out what is the context that people position themselves in. So what are some trends that you're seeing now that might be helpful for all of us to know?
Well, there's two very big things going on out there that have created a new normal in what I call the marketplace of ideas. And they are very disruptive, and they have changed the game. So here they are. First big change is you have a big switch in emphasis. In the good old days, getting out there was the emphasis. If you were highlighted in a prestigious place, you saw very quick results. Now, between the internet and social media, and content marketing, getting out there is no longer a big deal. We have plenty of opportunities to share our message,
mm-hmm.
okay? We have plenty of opportunities to put the spokes of the wheel out there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Instead, now, because of so many opportunities, you got a very noisy marketplace. So
mm-hmm.
now the emphasis has switched about getting heard above that noise.
Mm-hmm.
So the use of strategic position and positioning that hub has taken on a new emphasis and a new importance because it's not enough just to get out there. You have to be heard above the noise.
Okay, so being heard in itself is not effective anymore. You need
exactly.
to be heard above the noise.
You bet. You have to stand out. Standing out used to be defined as just showing up. Because there were fewer opportunities to play. Now
mm-hmm.
that there's so many megaphones out there, there's so many ways to get your information out there, plus the fact that some of the big boys are using a lot of content marketing to differentiate and position themselves, standing out is now the key emphasis. It's not getting your message out there. It's standing out in a noisy crowd.
So let me just add to that, that that's probably true no matter what industry you're talking about, not just authors and experts.
Oh, absolutely. It's affecting those segments. Yeah, it's disrupting everything.
Okay, good.
It's disrupting all sectors.
What's the second?
The second is because of this overwhelm in content marketing and ways to get out there, influence is now the new currency. You not only have to give more, Marcia, but you have to give different, okay? Your writing, your content, it's got to be more visual. It's got to show more differentiation. Here's the big challenge for copywriters. Writing the same ideas with different words, that's out. That is out. That no longer cuts it. Asking great questions that everyone's heard before, that's a given. That's a baseline. That's not a differentiator. So you have, so what's harder here is that you have to create copywriting. You have to tell stories. You have to get content out there that people used to pay for but is now being given away for free in order to influence, in order to differentiate. So that is putting an emphasis, again, on a more strategic issue, not just implementation. So the bottom line here is, because of these disruptions, is whoever has the best strategy is going to win, because they're going to influence, they're going to rise above the noise.
Okay, so if we get back to the example of Marcus Buckingham,
mm-hmm.
when he positions himself as the architect of the strengths revolution, nobody else has that position, and therefore he can be influential. And if he were giving out the same message as everybody else, he wouldn't be influential in this marketplace, right?
Exactly. Here's what he did is, in a world, he was a credible alternative to the status quo. So he looked at how people were being evaluated in the world of work, and he said, you guys have it backwards. He says, you guys are trying to shore up weaknesses, and I'm telling you, because of our research through Gallup, that will never be effective. You have to instead accentuate someone's strengths and build that up and make sure that they are in a position to use those strengths effectively. And so every bit of content that he puts out there is not just the idea that you use your strengths, but he now has all sorts of free stuff that helps you measure your strengths and helps you determine what your strengths could do and how you could be. So his tools have become far more diagnostic.
Uh-huh.
People used to pay for that.
So what you're saying is he's gone beyond content marketing to give people practical tools.
Exactly.
And he's also very focused.
Exactly. So it's focused, so it's practical with the focus.
Okay, and so really, it's the ease of communicating in this wired world that is creating this disruptive new normal, right?
Yes, exactly. It's how easy can people get content. Look at YouTube as a great another example. You can get in-depth tutorials on just about anything. Just about anything. Look at some of the higher education institutions, the Ivy Leaguers, that are putting some of their content online for free. This disruption is they're redefining what free content really is.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be free content was just information. It was ideas. Now it's going into diagnostic. Now it's going into in-depth tutorials. So practical with the focus. Very simple.
So do you think that I know that a lot of the people who are listening today are small operations, maybe just themselves with an assistant.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that somebody in that kind of situation can be heard above the noise today?
Oh, absolutely. That's the beauty of it, Marcia. The Internet has equalized everybody. The big boys can play along with the smaller folks, and no one can tell the difference.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah, you bet it is. This is cause for a happy dance. Oh, yeah. It used to be, you look at the tools that are out there now for people to get their ideas out there. Oh, my goodness. There are places where you can gamify your ideas, where you could take an idea and turn it into a game, for goodness sakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of that has plummeted. Oh, don't get me started. Oh, please. We'll be here for 3 days. Well, 3 days, I'm telling you.
Okay. So let's talk about another trend. And in the professional speaking market where you come from, people are talking about relevance. And relevance is another one of those words that might mean different things to different people. And in your research of the marketplace, how do the clients and customers, the people who were trying to be hired by, how do they define relevance?
You know, that's an excellent question, because right now relevance is a very big word, and it's used by a variety of people. Here's what I'm seeing from a trend standpoint. Relevance is a mix of practical and aspirational with a focus. Okay? If you give practical messages that people don't care about, you're going to be seen as nice to have, but you're not going to be heard. You know, you're just going to be seen as nice to have. If, on the other hand, you're talking about stuff people care about, but you don't have practical tools or ideas, if you're not doing those diagnostic things that we just talked about, you're going to get a bump of attention, but you're not going to get any traction. No one's going to buy anything from you. You're going to have a great list, but no sales. So you're going to be labeled with all platitudes and no usefulness. So that's what's going on right now. Relevant messages, this trend really forces us to see our buyers where they are and not where we would like them to be. And
could
I'm just
going to say a little bit more about what you mean by aspirational. I understand
sure.
The practical part.
Aspirational is hopeful.
Oh.
Look back at Marcus Buckingham. Don't you heave a sigh of relief knowing that you can leave your weaknesses behind and that you can create anything that you want to create by focusing on your strengths, on stuff that you're already good at?
So how is that different from being, let's say, a motivational speaker with some practical tools?
Well, because a lot of motivational speakers don't have practical tools.
Okay.
They just say, you can do it. Here's some stories about how you can do it.
Uh-huh.
Or why you can do it, or proof that you can do it.
Uh-huh.
Motivational speakers are usually pretty full of platitudes. They're
uh-huh.
they're hopeful, but they don't have diagnostics.
Uh-huh. So when people come to you and they're missing one of these two ingredients, which one are they usually missing?
They're usually missing the focus. And they're usually, I get about an even ratio of both. Sometimes contract trainers will come to me and they'll have a great collection of practical tools, but there's no focused type of hope that they're offering. Like I just talked to someone the other day and I said, you know what, you're in a low fee category. You got practical tools that are being used by contract trainers everywhere. It's different words, but the same idea, and you're going for 25 cents on the dollar, and you can't sustain that as a business model.
So,
and then I'll get other people who are aspirational, and I'll say, you know what, there's no practical application to your message. You're sounding like everybody else. Let's look at the territory that you can define and put your aspirations there. And then add some practical tools on top of that.
So the aspiration is, you said hope, but isn't it also the overarching goal, the meaningful goal that people are trying to reach?
It's the thing that hits people in their hearts.
Yes.
It's the thing that emotionally connects. You know, Marcus Buckingham is a great example of this. Just think, you don't have to do stuff that you're not good at. Isn't that a relief?
So from me watching you, Vicki, let me just take a guess about how this fits with your own positioning.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who get a taste of speaking and they have a dream of being that person up on the stage who gets the standing ovations and who makes a lot of money doing that. So mm-hmm. that would be an example of the aspiration. And then you combine that with practical tools and focus on how to get there. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say the most up-to-date version of that, because I was doing that, I started out with speakers, but since the mid-90s, I've been working with thought leaders in many different kind of industries.
Okay.
So I would revise that and say the aspirational part of my positioning is I help turn good experts into sought-after thought leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of talented people out there that know they have something to give, but they don't know how to give it. They don't know where to give it. They don't know the biggest value of their gifts. And if you're trying to generate revenue, those are some pretty big questions to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So as a market strategist for thought leaders, I can turn good, talented experts into someone that is sought after, where they get access to all sorts of opportunities they haven't even thought of yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the aspirational part of my positioning. When people think of my work, they think, oh, I can only imagine this thriving business where I get all sorts of cool opportunities that I haven't even thought of yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
so when you combine their brilliance to the marketplace, that's at that intersection, that sweet spot is where those opportunities lie.
Okay. So in your work, I imagine that probably every day it happens that you're looking at someone's bio or their homepage and you see that they're making some kind of major positioning blunder. And, of course, they're not your clients, so you just keep it to yourself, but you're probably going, you know, here we go again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you give us a few examples of positioning mistakes that you see very often?
Sure. The biggest mistake that I see is what I call the talented but nondescript. These are the folks, and consultants are the most guilty parties, I got to tell you. They are very good at accurately describing what they do, but they stop there, okay? They don't define the territory. So what they'll do is they'll say, I'm a great consultant, or I'm a high-growth consultant, and they stop there. And they say, don't you want to grow your business without losing sleep at night? Well, yeah, but everyone asks that question. So they look talented. They look like they have a fan club, but they're nondescript. And the problem with that is when people don't know what to do with you, then they'll do nothing. So they're like, well, this person's talented, but what do I do with them specifically? And there's a lot of them out there just like him, so I get to decide on price. So that's a big mistake that I see.
They haven't differentiated themselves enough. Is that what?
Well, they haven't defined their territory. Like, for example, if you're a high growth consultant, that's great, but what do you do in that space? What's your territory in that space? How do you contribute to the conversation in that space? Let me give you an example from Kirk, a client that I worked with earlier this year, and he's given me permission to use his story. We needed to position him away from all the other high-growth consultants out there. So we focused on a point of view about the journey that high-growth businesses take and what that journey looks like and what are some of the pitfalls. Well, he turned that into a book, and then he hired me to message that book for him to make sure that that book would be a blockbuster book. Well, 4 days after launch, it got on the bestseller list of CEO Reads, which is perfect for him because, again, he works with CEOs. And within 45 days after that book launch, he got his first speech at $15,000. That's significant.
So what was his new positioning?
His new positioning was defining the territory within the high-growth companies. He redefined that journey. And so what he did in defining the territory is instead of saying, here's how you grow your company, he talked about how success could kill your company.
Oh.
So he said, here are the pitfalls, here are the hidden pitfalls to success that you don't even know about.
Uh-huh.
So he normalized the journey. He looked at where his clients were, which was this roller coaster ride called growth, and he redefined it and said, you know what, it doesn't have to be that journey. Here's why it's coming off like that.
So, in other words, he changed the conversation
that people were having in that topic area. Yes, and in order to change the conversation, you have to know the conversation that's taking place now by other high-growth consultants in his case. That's where the market strategy comes in. That's where knowing your competition comes in. Because we figured out together the hole in the market that he could dominate. That became his territory.
Uh-huh.
So normalizing that journey, talking about that journey in different terms, just like Marcus Buckingham talked about using strengths in different terms, that defined the territory, and that allowed him to dominate a section of that market.
So in order to come up with positioning as a thought leader, do you have to be controversial?
No.
No.
No. I mean, if you get too controversial, and this goes back into tone for copywriting, you know, if you look like you're obnoxious without a cause, you're a clown. I mean, no one's going to pay attention to that.
Well, you can be controversial without being a clown.
Yeah, you have to be different. You don't have to be controversial. It depends on what you call controversial. To me, controversial means that's a good question. I don't think you have to be confrontational. You have to stand out. You have to redefine the landscape. You have to add something significant to the conversation. Now, right now, reframing the problem, that's going for free. All right, so thought leaders who focus on reframing a problem, they're going to get into the free category way too quick. But if you can redefine something the thing that changes everything,
mm-hmm.
then you become a disruptive force for good.
Okay, so disruptive, being disruptive is pretty much what I meant by
okay, all right, then we're on the same page then.
Good. Do you have another example of positioning mistakes?
Another great example in the bio, because you were talking about the bio. When I'm checking out potential clients, that's the first page I go to after the homepage of their website, because I want to see how they describe themselves. Again, people will start at the beginning and give all the details. They will tell their story without any kind of a focus. They're just telegraphing that they're talented out there. And that's not enough. I mean, no one cares about your childhood until they understand your relevance. So bios without strategic use of details, they're unfocused, they don't differentiate. Again, you look talented but nondescript.
Yeah, I actually work with a lot of people on their bios, and I get the rough draft. And as you said, it's telling a story. It's telling a chronological story. And instead, they need to have a theme.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, everything in that bio has to relate to the theme.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Anything else that happens really often when you look at people's websites and you just, you know, oh, well.
Well, it's don't get me started. Again, we could talk about this for 3 days about copywriting mistakes. Another big mistake that I see is when the message doesn't match the market or the business model. I'll never forget a conversation I had with a client. He says, you know, I want to use the same kind of copywriting that, you know, Billy Bob over here does, you know, Big Cheese Speaker. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because they're making a lot of money. And I said, well, they're making a lot of money in this particular market segment. Are you in that market segment? He said, no. And I said, well, let's talk about what that segment looks like. And I told him, and I said, do you want to be in that market segment? Do you think you fit in that market segment? And he said, Nope. So I said, then perhaps that tone of copywriting would not work for you. Let's look at the market segment you belong in and then look at the tone and the kind of wording, the verbiage, the messaging that works in that market segment.
Mm-hmm.
He got it.
Yeah. It has to work not only for the market segment, but it also has to fit how you relate to people. So if you if you're imitating somebody who has a different way of putting themselves out in the world, it's probably not going to work for you.
Oh, yeah. And again, I know because I'm talking to a bunch of copywriters here, it's also the tone. You know, different tones work in different segments. For example, if you get real, the word hype is redefined in many different areas. If you're in a sales area, you know, hyping is going to look very different than if you are in a more IT environment or a more corporate operational environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are, you know, and that happens not only on websites but speaking and everywhere else. You know, I just finished speaking earlier this year to a group that's very, very practical. And for them, the hype meter was set on, you know, very delicate. And if you even look like you were saying something aspirational without any kind of facts to back it up, you know, they just eat you alive.
Yeah.
So the different segments have a different definition of, you know, of relevance and hype and all that kind of stuff.
Well, let's get back to the bio and talk about what suggestions you have other than don't make it chronological. So what other suggestions do you have for writing a bio that really impresses people, not just that you're talented, because as you said, that's a given now, but what else does the bio need to do and how do you do it?
Well, the bio has to do three things. One, it has to show that you're uniquely qualified. Two, you have to show what you're doing with that talent, which is defining the territory. And then three, it has to show from outside forces or outside facts that you are successful in your endeavors. Okay? So let's, just in the spirit of practicality, Marcia, let's drill down on the most important part of the bio, which is the first sentence. You know, that, you know, you talked about setting the theme. You know, that first sentence sets the stage for everything else that you're going to say in that bio, every story you tell. There are two things that first sentence has to have. One, it has to have a label that identifies what you do, and two, it has to identify your territory, how you use the expertise that you just labeled. Now, a fabulous example, one of my favorite examples, is from best-selling author and TED speaker Dan Ariely. I think I pronounced his last name right.
Ariely.
Yes, thank you. God,
yeah.
Dollars, I do that every time. Now, look at the first sentence in his TED bio. You know, he is a behavioral economist who studies irrationality. Now, that is short, sweet, and to the point. Let's break it down. Behavioral economist sounds authoritative. Now, people may not know exactly what all that is, but it sounds impressive. It sounds scientific. It sounds evidence-based. So corporate America, business markets love that stuff, okay? Then he claims the territory, right?
Yeah.
He studies irrationality.
You know what? If I were working, of course I don't know what the rest of the bio says, but if I were working on that bio, I would add one more element, which is I would say something like, as a behavioral economist who studies irrationality, Dan Ariely, and then the rest of the sentence talks about his impact.
Oh,
that's
sure.
What I
that
would
comes
do.
Later. Yeah, I'm just talking about the first sentence.
I would put it in the first sentence. But,
okay.
You know, this is a matter of preference. So go,
oh, sure.
Go ahead. Tell me. I mean, you're the guest today, so tell
oh,
us
no, no.
how you
I
would
just,
do it.
I agree with you that the impact needs to be right up there. I also have a rule of thumb when I'm writing, which is so subjective, is anything over two lines is a sentence that's too long. So I have a tendency to keep the sentences as short as I can.
Okay.
And so, again, just probably a personal preference. But when you claim a territory like irrationality, it gives him wide berth to talk about all the silly decisions that we make, but it also has specific applications so that people can see exactly what they can do with this. Okay, so corporate America, that's why corporate America loves to hire him,
mm-hmm.
is because they can use his study on irrationality on customer behavior,
mm-hmm.
how to influence customer behavior. That is specific, but that's not all that he's about.
So I'm thinking that the rest of his bio needs to spell out how he does that in different arenas. Because I know, even though he's a behavioral economist, he talks about a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to give the people looking at that bio some idea of the range of applicability of his expertise so that those readers can see themselves in the bio.
Absolutely. And there's a variety of ways to do that. He could give a range of his clients. He could tell stories. He could do all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
Sure.
Good. And how is he uniquely qualified? I would assume that the bio would need to give some indication of ways in which he's actually leading that charge. So not only that he wrote a best-selling book, but that people look to him, that he was the first, or he's the foremost in some way, or he's won awards and all that kind of stuff. Just
that third party stuff that I was talking about. Also, folks like him have they're in academia,
yeah.
So he can talk about his work in MIT and other Ivy League institutions. But even folks that don't work in Ivy League institutions, you talk about the facts in your background that support that unique qualifications. That's what I meant by focused, and that's why you don't want to have a bio that's chronological. It just doesn't make sense.
Good. So let's switch now from a bio opening and tone that really works to something that you look at it and it comes across as pure hype. So what would be an example of a positioning statement in a bio that's just so fluffy or meaningless or over the top?
Well, outrageous claims based on half-truths really get me going. Okay, so here's an example. I see this a lot in the marketplace. I did this for this famous person so I can do it for anyone. No, that is not true at all. Famous people have a lot more options than us mere mortals. A lot of times the person's role was a lot smaller than they make it out to be. I've worked with all these famous people, therefore I can make you famous too. That's just a bunch of hooey. So that is... any kind of bold claim without the story, the telling the whole truth there is really in hype and in the high hype zone for me. I think here's another one. Anyone can leap off of tall buildings with a single bound. Just buy my stuff first. Positioning your offers as a silver bullet that will cure all ills, and anybody, no matter how unqualified, can do this, is just, again, it's playing on people's hopes and fears, and you're not telling the full truth. So if you're not telling what the journey really looks like, to me, that's real high hypey.
Okay, so it needs to be believable in real-world terms, not just what people wish would happen.
Exactly. Exactly. Like I tell people all the time, I'm not selling magic wands here. You know, you're gonna use this analysis, you're gonna use my findings, and you're gonna have to implement them. You're gonna have to write about stuff that you may not have written about before. You're gonna have to maybe change your website to convey a different tone, so that it matches your best clients because you weren't doing that. Or, hey, you're in mass market and you're acting like you're in corporate. You got to make a decision one way or the other. Here's the pros and cons. So, you know, I try real hard, especially in my blog post, to really paint a realistic picture about what's going on out there without, you know, staying in the, you know, taking a long trip to the dark side.
Mm-hmm. So,
Marsha, I just want to make this point real quick. What happens when you use that type of language, when you say, you know, I did it for famous people, so I can do it for anybody, and you can do it, you just have to buy your stuff. What happens is we attract the desperate. We attract people who need far more help than what we're selling. And when we do that, that's just a train wreck waiting to happen. And we also repel the people who are smart because they see right through those type of claims. They know not everybody can be a famous speaker, or they know not everybody can do this or that. So you get the dreamers who ask for a refund the moment reality sets in when you set yourself up with these kind of messages.
Well, that's a wonderful encapsulation of I totally agree, and I haven't heard it said quite that way, that hype attracts desperate people and it repels the smart ones who have a more realistic understanding. And those of us who prefer to work with the smart ones, that gives us another reason to stay away from hype.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It will repel your best clients, I promise you.
Great. So One kind of message where people are tempted to be hypey is conveying some sort of urgency. I've seen it. The question come out, how can I compel people to buy? And that word compel really gets to me because I think that they're just trying too hard. So how do you not try hard, too hard, but try hard enough?
Bribery. One word, bribery. I mean, it's a balancing act. I mean, if you go in too soft, people think they can wait. If you go in too strong, well, now you're in the high hype zone. So here's the balance. You give enough to make it worth acting upon, but you're also okay if they don't move. So you really have to detach from outcome. You say, here's what we're going to do extra if you're willing to act now. But after that date, you don't get the benefits. You don't get the goodies. And you have to enforce that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was in a particular venue where people did not believe that I had deadlines for whatever reason. I think because a lot of the other speakers don't. And they would contact me after the deadline, and I'd say, I'm so sorry, you're too late. And they're like, well, wait a minute. And I'm like, no, there is no, you've waited a minute. That's the problem. You know, you waited too many minutes. You know, that's the problem. And I wasn't a real jerk about it. Like, if they were 5 minutes late, I'd be okay. But people would come to me a week later and say, I want to do this. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you're too late. And they're like, you're not going to take my money? And I said, that's correct. And it blew their minds.
Well, here's a statement I found in one of your articles or on your website somewhere. I really like this. Clever articulation without strategy is like throwing a high-end cocktail party in a dive bar. I love that. And can you just unpack that and tell us what you mean by it?
Sure, sure. That was one of my favorites, too. What I meant is a great message in the wrong place will never work. You can dress up the words all you want, but if the strategy is off, the wheels fall off. I can't tell you how many times this happens, Marsha. You know, here's an example. I had a speaker client that came back to me after getting the findings, and he said, you know, the strategy wasn't working. The strategy is off. It's not working. I tried implementing it. It's not working. You're wrong. You've missed something. And I'm like, okay, well, let's check it out. and I CSI'd it, and I looked at his copy. And you wouldn't believe what I found. I found a great message for a keynote speaker, but the language and format used was for the training industry. These were two different markets who see themselves as separate. I about fell out of my chair. So that is exactly what he did. He got himself all dressed up as a keynote speaker, but he went to the training market, and then he couldn't figure out why it wouldn't work. That's getting dressed up and going to the wrong party.
Mm-hmm. Because every market has its particular expectations, and if you ignore those, then they're going to ignore you.
Exactly. Exactly. And they have their unwritten code. For example, in the training industry, you have to give learning outcomes. That's not expected in a keynote presentation. If you say that in a keynote presentation, you've just positioned yourself as a trainer masquerading as a keynote speaker, and anyone in their right mind's not going to hire you because they're scared to death now that you're going to be boring.
Mm-hmm. Great example.
Thanks.
So let's suppose that somebody is sitting down to write, and what should they be thinking about before they write a word?
Well, first, you got to know your competition. You have to articulate the hole in the market that only you can fill. You have to show the reader that they're going to get secrets that they can't get anywhere else. So when everyone describes the same outcome, the same result, it's hard for buyers to decide on anything at price. So you have to know and articulate that difference. And in order to know and articulate that difference, you have to know your competition. So you can't just say, for example, I get results. Everybody says that. You won't be considered different. So the base of the strategic direction and the message of your writing is based on an unconscious comparison between you and your competition, and you have to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to know that before you ever write a word. Second, you have to know your territory. What slice of the marketplace do you want to dominate? Don't try to take on too much. That's a big mistake I see in a lot of positioning. You know, give a business case. What is the top five things that prove your value?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to use myself as an example. My clients say stuff that I could never make up. I mean, they will tell you exactly the results that they get. I got one client that got a $250,000 contract using the findings from my work. Now, he's the one that pitched it. He's the one that had to, you know, nurture the sales relationship. You know, the findings just didn't do that by themselves. But because he had those findings, he got the deal. All right, I couldn't make that stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people can't say that. What my competitors say is, oh, my clients love me, but they can't point to a specific dollar amount. They can't point to a deal. I had a client that generated between $600,000 and $800,000 in new revenue the first year after working with me. You know, that's all without cold calling. That's strategic direction. That's knowing your competition. That's knowing your territory. So you have to build a business case, but you can't build that business case unless you know the territory that you need to dominate.
Uh-huh. Great. So when I introduced you, Vicki, I talked about your evolution, and you talked also about your evolution a bit. And I'm sure you've learned some lessons along the way about how you should and shouldn't position yourself. So what would some of those lessons be?
You know, that's a fabulous question because I have learned a lot. I learned that I needed to show my humanity a little bit more. You know, as a strategist, I thought no one cared about me as a person. They just wanted to know what I could do for them. So I led with data and analysis and facts and all that kind of stuff. And people are interested in that, and that's true. But folks also have to trust me. So what I learned in my positioning is by showing up more fully, to allow people to see my heart. I learned that folks trust that I will tell them the truth in a way that empowers them, and that there's a big emotional component to the decision to work with all of us. And one of the things I heard from clients is how much they appreciate my caring about their success. You know, they had no idea how all in I was for them. You know, I had one client say, "Vicki, you fight for us. You have no idea the value of that." And so I had to learn that the intangibles were just as important as the tangibles.
So how did you add that to your, what did you add it to, and how did you insert that element?
Well, before social media, I inserted that in my conversations. So when people would contact me and reach out, I would get to know them as people first. And I would listen very intently to their dreams and to their hopes. And I would pay a lot of attention to them. And I would just kind of soften a little bit, you know, because I used to be, because I've been in business for almost 30 years. And what I used to do is believe that with the right information, I could help people. Well, what I've since learned is some people don't want to be helped at that moment that I have information for them. And, you know, sometimes you're interfering in their journey. And so you have to be careful of that. And so I did it at first with conversations. And then with social media, I've now inserted that in social media. In fact, I've learned, strangely enough, on Facebook that I get the most likes and the most comments when I talk about things personal. It's crazy. I mean,
by personal, you mean like where you went on your vacation or you were upset about something? I mean, tell me more about what you mean by that.
Sure. Like I give updates. Again, here's an example. 2014 for me has been the year of the big clean out. So I'm cleaning out my house. You know, I'm throwing stuff away. I'm giving stuff away. You know, we're shredding a bunch of documents. I mean, and so I have put in little updates on Facebook. I'd say the big clean out of this year continues. Yay to my husband. He's given away to Goodwill 7 cases of books. He's a book reader. He's a book lover. Kudos to him for doing this. You know, somebody's going to love this stuff. I got all sorts of likes for that. I just put an entry on Facebook. I just finished celebrating my 20th wedding anniversary, you know, and so I made mention of that. And I said, time flies when you're married to the right one. Boy, I got a ton of likes and comments about that. I mean, who knew that people would care that I was married for 20 years? I had no idea.
Well, I understand how that would get responses on Facebook. But tell me more about how that plays into your ability to get the kind of clients that you want, which is really, I mean, that's not what we're about, just getting likes on Facebook.
Correct.
So tell me how that plays into people wanting to work with you.
Well, here's what I think, and I don't have an analysis to prove this because I've never asked a questionnaire, but people have told me that they want to work with me because they've connected with me.
Mm-hmm.
So what I hear is people say, you know, I love your energy, or you know what, this is a good fit. So when people say to you, this is a good fit, I think that's just as much emotional as it is objective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what I do in my conversations, which is what I started with in my sales conversations, and then on social media, I do less in LinkedIn but more personal on Facebook. When people get to know you, they get to decide whether you're going to be a good fit before they ever contact you.
So is that something that you would incorporate back into the bio in some way or in your testimonials or
apart
from social media, where else would you put that component?
Are you talking about on the website?
Wherever in your marketing.
In my marketing, I use it in sales conversation where I reach out and talk a lot about, you know, personal stuff with the person I'm talking to as well as myself so we can kind of get to know each other as human beings. I also put it in my bio. I also, as we said, put in social media. I also have a little bit of it in my blog posts, particularly around the holidays, Thanksgiving, you know, the Christmas or, you know, winter holidays. I'll do something a little bit more personal.
So we're getting up to the hour, and my last question before we go off and do Q&A. Suppose you had a magical megaphone that's going to reach everybody out there who's just dreaming of being heard and making a difference. And what's the one thing you would want to tell them about positioning that they need to understand?
Strategy trumps hype every day. The results you get from your writing is determined by the strategic decisions you make before you write a single word. That is the game changer. Market strategy is like the wind. You can't see it, but it's still there. It's there, and it makes a difference. And that difference is between doing the work and getting big results and doing the work and getting radio silence. Mm-hmm. When you have the right strategy with the right words, the reaction from the marketplace is magical.
Well, that's exciting. Tell us, Vicki, before we open up for questions, you have a special offer for our listeners. So tell us about that.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. A lot of people, after I show up and have these kind of conversations, they're always curious about their situation. You know, what, you know, how are they coming off? What their competitors look like? You know, how are they being compared? That kind of stuff. And so in the spirit that the sharpest knife can't carve its own handle, what I am doing is kind of opening up the calendar a little bit and working with people on what I call strategy sessions. And the strategy sessions have pretty wide berth. You can ask me anything. I'll look at your website if you want me to. I'm not going to read books or look at, you know, 2-hour videos. That's a little bit much. But I can take a look at your stuff and give you some feedback. I can answer any kind of questions that you want. I don't work by the hour. Most of my projects start between $10,000-$15,000, and so I'm out of reach for a lot of the smaller businesses, but the strategy sessions are a good start for people who have specific questions, and so I'm just making it easy and saying, listen, you know, I'll do this for $450 if you feel that my findings and I can give you some valuable suggestions, then I want to make that accessible for everybody on the call. You just go to VickiSullivan.com/no-hype. So that's VickiE Sullivan.com, no-hype. And you'll see some additional information. I'll digitally record the session so you can get every word. It is not a sales pitch. You're not going to hear me suggest one additional thing that you need to do with me. It's all information, and if you want to sign up for my blog, there's going to be a little column there on the right side that will, you can put your name and email address, and that's all free and stuff. But this is just an ability or a way for people to get help that would ordinarily not, because you know sometimes we're so close to our situation that we don't know what we don't know. And, you know, all of us need some help along the way. So if you want to kind of step out of the box and not do it yourself, this is an opportunity to do that. I firmly believe that if you're trying to do it all yourself, then like attorneys who represent themselves, you know, we've got some fools for clients. So this is just a way to help people to answer specific questions without the normal high price tag that can be inaccessible for folks.
Well, thanks for that, Vicki, and I hope that some people do take advantage of that. And we now are opening up for Q&A. And if you're listening on the web, you can type your question into the box at the left of your screen where it says submit your question. And if you're on the live call and you have a question for Vicki, well, all you have to do is press star 2 on your phone pad, and that will show up on my console as you are raising your hand. So again, on the web, type your question into the box where it says submit your question. And if you're on the phone, then press star 2 on your phone pad. So I do have a question here from somebody who's on the web, Vicki. And the question is, why is it that very smart people make dumb positioning moves?
I think it's because they just don't know what they don't know, and they don't have an outsider that'll tell them. I really believe that. I also believe that sometimes people drink their own Kool-Aid. I had a conversation with someone the other day who thought he was right because he's been right before, and the problem was he just hadn't been in the marketplace long enough to know he was wrong. So a lot of folks just don't know what they don't know.
So it's a kind of blindness, or it's that they don't understand strategy, or that they're just thinking about what's the message they want to give out, and that's it. So here's my
exactly.
Message.
They look. That's another great mistake that a lot of smart people make, is they get so focused on their passion, they have no idea how the marketplace sees them. And that's one of the things that we talk about in the 1 hour, is how is the marketplace perceiving what you just wrote?
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's key information, so you can change or not change, do whatever you want. But a lot of people don't understand how they're being perceived.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and for some reason, there's some people just have a disconnect between the words that they write and the goal that they have in their head.
Sure, or they'll fall in love with the words. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, there's times when I'll fall in love with a turn of phrase or a particular paragraph, but I'll cut it. I'll cut it because it won't work. And I'm like, oh, man, I feel like I'm killing a kid or something. And I'm not, but it's like, what's that saying from a famous author? You know, let's kill our darlings, you know, something like that. So it's a blindness. I think we fall in love for the wrong reasons. I think we don't know what we don't know. There's a lot of reasons. I think success can blind us. I think I talk to a lot of people who are successful in other fields, and they think that means they know a bunch of stuff in this field that they don't know. So I see that. So, yeah, I think it's just ignorance and blind spots and a disconnect. And that is why we are here for one another. Is to help, because everyone's got blind spots.
Do you ever work with technical people who are trying to put out a wider message, and do they have any particular blind spots that you have to work with them on?
Oh, I love technical people. I'm married to an engineer, so I have a special place in my heart for technical people. What I find with technical people is, what's great about them is they know they don't know the market, so they're easier to work with because they know they don't know. The problem with technical people is they get caught up in being correct. And they're so caught up in being technically correct, they don't understand that there's some details that the marketplace doesn't care about. And so that's where the biggest blind spot I see with technical people. But, yeah, I work with them, and I love doing so.
Because I know, I'm thinking of all the times that I go to some kind of technical website and I've heard that this is a company that does such and such and it's going to help me solve a particular problem. And I get there and I look at the message there and either I can't make head or tails out of it, or they're making so many assumptions about what I know and I don't know, and they're not making any connection at all with what I went there for, and they just lose me.
Oh, yeah, because technical people, it's real easy for them to talk over somebody's head, and this goes from ignorance of their marketplace. They don't understand what their marketplace does not know, which is great for them because that allows them to be a service to that marketplace, but the bad news is they've got to take baby steps. So when I talk to technical people, I'll say, number one, don't showcase your methodology. People care more about the impact of what you do versus how you're going to do it. And secondly, you're going to have to talk to people as if they're first graders. You know, you're going to have to start that slow because they don't know what you know. They don't know. They have no idea. The things that you think everybody knows, everybody doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So do you find that when we were talking earlier about the practical and the aspirational, that they lean way too far on the practical side?
Yeah, they're accurate without being compelling.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seduce the marketplace. And, again, I'm talking generally speaking. They think the facts are enough, and it isn't. You know, you got to give people something to get excited about.
Mm-hmm. So last chance, I'm not seeing any hands up. If there's anybody who's still on the phone who has a question for Vicki, press star 2 on your phone pad, and then I'll recognize you and you can ask your question. If you're on the web, then put your question into the submit your question box. And let's see if anybody's hands has gone up. No. So, any final words, Vicki?
I just want people to know that there is a marketplace for everybody. I believe that if you're on the planet, you have a purpose. And so the key is not really changing who you are or changing what you do. It's really that intersection between finding your place in the marketplace, finding that place that you can dominate, that you are just the bee's knees, so to speak. That's where you're going to find the fabulous opportunities that are just for you.
Wonderful. I want to thank Vicki Sullivan for sharing her perspectives on positioning with us today. I know I have a lot to think about. I'm definitely going to listen to this whole interview again. And I hope that you'll share your insights, thoughts, and realizations from today's discussion on our Facebook page, which is www.facebook.com/NoHypeSummit, no hyphens. This is Marcia Yedkin, founder and moderator for the No Hype Copywriting Telesummit. And I want to thank you for listening, and bye for now.